Over 30 League, Sean Silver with you for this All-Star Weekend bonus edition. Joining me is Pete Croato, author of the book From Hang Time to Prime Time, Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern Day NBA. Pete, it's a dense title, it's a dense topic, but for a hoophead like me, I thoroughly enjoyed this, and I'm excited to talk to you.
Thank you, Sean. Pleasure to be on, and thanks for reading the book.
Yeah, absolutely. This conversation's long overdue for me. I started reading your book shortly after Christmas. I was in the hospital in Providence, Rhode Island for a good reason. My daughter was born.
Oh,
so
congratulations.
I was cradling her, and during her few moments of quiet, I was starting to kind of absorb the book, and that continued. It took me a lot longer to read it than I wanted it to, just because when she goes off, that book is being put down. So
I have a four-year-old daughter, so I'm very well aware of, I can't tell you how many books, movies, television shows have been interrupted for good reasons. You know, to read a book from start to finish when you have a child, especially a young child, it should be an Olympic event. So my hat's off to you for finishing that book. Was this your first, or?
This is my second. So this is kind of where I wanted to start here, because my son will be three in April. So we have toddlers, I guess, for better or for worse, you could call them. Mm-hmm. And now I have an infant. How the hell do you write a 300-page book with a toddler in your midst?
It's a very good question, and it is the best way I can answer that question is I took advantage of every window of time that I had. We were lucky. I started writing this book when my daughter turned two, or was about to turn two. So she was in daycare. So the hours that she was at daycare, I wrote and reported, and I used any spare window of time that I had to write and report. That's the thing. When you're a parent, you learn to really embrace any window of time that you have, any free period of time. So the days of being of working from home and just spending 2 hours like catching up on NBA trade rumors and like looking at YouTube clips of Rounders, like Goodfellas, like that goes out the window. Like I had to really just bust my ass, and just if I had 6 hours to work, like that time was spent working and making phone calls and getting my 1,000 words in. So when I was writing the book, you know, I had a routine that I fell into. So my wife would typically drop our daughter off at around 8, and I would spend an hour watching King of the Hill reruns on Comedy Central. Then I would head downstairs to my office and just write my 1,000 words. And sometimes it took 3 hours, sometimes it took 5 hours, but that was my routine and I stuck with it. And that really is what you have to do. That's really what I did, was I was just very disciplined about it. Especially because to me, there were a couple of things on the line. First, it was, I wanted to get paid for finishing the book. Definitely. And I owed it to myself. You know, this is a book that I've been percolating in my head for years, and I wanted to get it out. I owed it to myself. I owed it to the struggling freelancer in me to get it out there and have it be read. So it was hard, and then it got easy, because again, like, it just becomes a normal thing. Like, you get up, you have your breakfast, you get downstairs, you write the book.
Yeah. Well, heartfelt congratulations, A, on getting it done.
Thank you. Praise
for your time management skills. And I mean, that's not a trite thing coming from me. I'm a guy who's written at a lot of places on the internet over a lot of years. And I'd like to think, you know, maybe I've got something like that in me. It's not getting done right now with a newborn. Let's put it that way. But it's the sort of thing where it's like, hey, you know, this guy and I think we got a little bit in common. We're both hoop fans. History of the game interests us. We got young kids.
Sure.
And, look, he was able to do it. So, you know, maybe my moment is coming up somewhere.
It will. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I you know, I'm 43, and I think there's a tendency to think, oh, well, you know, I'm 35 or I'm 30 or the window has passed. The window never passes. It's a matter of just chipping away at it, you know. And again, like, you know, with me, my first book, I spent about 4 or 5 years working on articles that contributed to that eventually found their way into the book, or that helped me toward creating a list of sources that I could go to when the book got got to prove. So that's the thing. I mean, there's always time. Like, there is always time. And again, you know, I think you're in a better position than a lot of people. You know, because you're writing articles, you're cultivating sources, you're doing the things that you need to do.
Yeah.
So to, you know, I'm always getting people say, oh, well, it's too late or it's too this. It's never too late. It's a matter of just finding the way to do it and failing and, you know, not being afraid to get your ass kicked every once in a while.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I feel like sometimes I'm getting my ass kicked is freelance pitches. And, you know, obviously there's, I've read some of the stuff that you've written about getting out there as a freelancer, and again, time management, you know, making the big pitch, following it to fruition. The genesis of this whole thing is an article you wrote for Grantland back when that was kind of the gold standard of sports writing on the internet. Yeah. And that was about Marvin Gaye at the 83 All-Star Game singing just what became a historic national anthem performance. Take me through the process of pitching that to Grantland, getting in there, and, you know, that's a yay, woo, pop the champagne. That would have been cool. After that, you turn this into a book, and how that came about.
The Grantland thing, getting into Grantland was an absolute thrill at the time. People tend to forget just how big or how what a gold standard Grantland was for sports writing, for pop culture writing. I mean, it was A-list talent. I mean, Colson Whitehead covered the World Series of Poker for Grantland. I mean, Chris Jones, who was a wonderful writer at Esquire, you know, he was covering the American League East. You know, the people who got into that, who were either full-time staff writers there or who had landed pitches there and had contributed, was insane. I mean, Katie Baker was a staff writer there. I mean, it was crazy. And I pitched the story. I mean, I thought I had no chance of getting in. And I got in there because, again, this is just the kind of, I don't know if it speaks to just networking or just luck, but I'd interviewed Michael Weinreb, who was a staff writer for Grantland. He had just written a book called Beyond the Game, which profiles three or four key 80s athletes who were skilled athletes, but also very image conscious. And I interviewed him for a site called Bibble Buffet, which was, you know, I had a sports books column there. So we had gotten fairly friendly. So I wrote to Michael. I said, hey, you know, if I wanted to pitch Grantland, who would I send a pitch to? And Michael was very kind to say, yeah, you know, try Sarah Lammer. She's my editor. You can pitch her. So I did that. I wrote an email to Sarah, wrote a pitch about doing a 30-year retrospective on Marvin Gaye's Anthem. I didn't think I'd hear anything back because, again, you know, I think the biggest site I had written for was Deadspin before Deadspin was taken over by corporate overlords. And, you know, I thought, okay, well, if I hear a friendly no thank you, I'll be thrilled. So I was amazed when she said, yeah, let's do this. And quickly it went from elation to panic because I had never written anything that long. I think they wanted 2,500 words.
Yeah.
And it was also for a major outlet. So after I picked up my jaw from the floor and worked on that piece, you know, it was a lot of work, but there are two things that were instrumental with that experience. First was that Sarah was a great editor and she helped me craft that piece. She helped me create or put together a long form nonfiction piece that actually had like layers to it and wasn't, you know, straightforward. It, to me, after I read it, after I finished that piece, pardon me, I felt like I had gone through a graduate level course in how to write long form. So that was the first thing that came out of that. And I'm indebted to Sarah, who now is at the Washington Post, for kind of holding my hand and saying, no, we're not going to start with a date in the lead. We're going to start with an anecdote and we're going to work our way down here.
Yeah.
She was great with that. But the second thing that came out of that piece was, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor and there's a lot of stuff about how important that anthem was that contributed to the future of the NBA and what the NBA would become. So after that piece ran, I thought, you know what, there's more to this. And I want to, and I think there's a book here. I think there's something more that I could do with this. So after getting that suspicion confirmed by a couple of friends of mine, I spent about 4 years, I think, 4 or 5 years working on sort of an idea in my head of what I wanted this book to be, and then going through and then working on stories that would contribute to that, to the narrative that's in the book.
Yeah.
So I did a couple pieces for Slam on All-Star Game weekend events that, you know, again, got me some more information, some more insights, helped me develop my source list. And I wrote a piece for RollingStone.com on Salem Sportswear, which was very, very big in the NBA's apparel, yep, strategy. And that kind of helped me, you know, as I did these pieces, I got more sources. I got people who I could go back to who weren't going to hang up on me if I called them. And I also kind of saw a clearer vision for what the book could become. So that Grantland piece was everything because it taught me how to write a long form. But it also opened me up to the possibility of writing a book, which before then was a pipe dream, clearly.
You mentioned that Salem Sports piece. And it's funny because as you recollect that process, it's like, mm-hmm, I remember reading that article. Yeah. You know, like I had no idea who you were at the time, but you were writing articles that were in my wheelhouse. So we'll definitely get back to Salem Sports.
Okay.
But that kind of plays a part in, you know, my genesis as an NBA fan where, mm-hmm, you know, I'm going to be 38 in a month now.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting the hand-me-downs from my cousins who lived up the street, and I got a bunch of those Salem Sportswear shirts. And for, mm-hmm, those listening who are uninformed, those are the basketball caricature shirts where the athletes had really big heads, and it expanded to all sports. Mm-hmm. You know, championship shirts where everyone had a big, yep, head. You had the whole team, the coach, etc. Pete, do you have any memories of, did you have Salem Sports t-shirts as a child? Who'd you have?
I did. I had a Walter Payton shirt.
Nice.
And I got it as a Christmas gift from a friend of mine. I'm not sure why Walter Payton, because I really wasn't a Bears fan. I grew up in New Jersey, so Walter Payton was someone I knew, but I wasn't a diehard fan. And I had a...
That would be like getting like a LeBron shirt for somebody nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a staple of...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. He was a superstar and he was known. So like you get a Walter Payton shirt. And I had a 1990 Major League Baseball All-Star shirt. So all the All-Stars.
Cool.
No, it was the starting lines of both All-Star teams on the shirt. It was a great shirt. I mean, a beautiful shirt. I wore the hell out of that.
Yeah. I'm thinking from that season, some of the guys that went on that shirt. Probably like Eric Davis and,
yep,
you know, Bash Brothers and all, you know.
Yeah,
all that
Griffey.
Stuff.
I mean, I think the starting pitchers, I remember Jack Armstrong was the pitcher for the Reds.
Oh, yeah.
That's going way back.
Jack Armstrong.
I had a couple of shirts, but I love those shirts. But no basketball shirts, oddly enough, which is odd. But my brother had a Jordan shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was
the crown jewel.
Yeah. He had a Jordan shirt. That was, and again, that's when Jordan was starting to become like LeBron. Just everyone, yeah, knew who Jordan was.
Right.
What about you? What shirts did you get handed down?
Oh gosh, there were a bunch. But the one that sticks out to me is Dominique Wilkins.
Ooh, that's
he's up in the air and he's, mm-hmm, got his finger, just like one finger gently, just kind of poking the ball through the,
yeah,
rim. It just looks like he's having the time of his life. And that, mm-hmm, that was a standout. I think I had Robert Parrish as my favorite player when I was a kid. So I definitely had the Chief. Again, these, yeah, were all hand-me-downs, but I think I had one that said Thump and Bump. It was Charles Barkley and Rick Mahorn.
Oh, that's good.
You know, despite my general distaste for Rick Mahorn as a player, you know, those early, late 80s, early 90s Sixers teams were fun. I mean, maybe not, yeah, as fun for Sixers fans as the 83 team, but they definitely, yeah, had some talent. So yeah, those are ones that stand out, and Barkley and Mahorn just look menacing as hell, you know? So that was all part of growing my love of the game, my interest in these personalities. It's probably a little different now. And you mentioned you got a 4-year-old. How do you cultivate a love of the sport, or do you even try with a 4-year-old girl?
No, you don't. I mean, you don't try. I mean, yeah, I think for me, as she gets older and she sees me and she has an awareness of what I enjoy as a sports fan, mm-hmm, and that I've written a sports book, I think that she'll become more aware of it, but I'm going to wait for her to come to me. I'm not going to voice my interests upon my child. I mean, if she sees me watching a basketball game and she wants to find out about it, that's great. Same thing. And she's expressed a little bit of interest in football, but I'm not going to indoctrinate her to you know, to my way of thinking. I think if she wants to learn more about sports and more about what I'm watching or what I follow, that's great. But I'm going to let her discover it on her own. I think it's one of the cool things about being a child is that discovery, is getting a chance to figure out, like, oh yeah, that's interesting, or oh, that's cool. And I want my daughter to have that experience. So yeah, I mean, I'm not going to sit her down and have her watch like old Kevin McHale highlights, or, you know, or have her watch NBA fan, dazzling dunks and basketball bloopers. I'm going to let her come to that naturally if she wants to.
I was going to say the dazzling dunks and basketball bloopers. About 6 feet to my left, I've got, I think it's called NBA Rewind. A relative found this tape.
Okay.
And I haven't watched it yet. During the pandemic here, just kind of finished off the basement, and it's a room down here, just one room. It's quite small, but I have a VCR down here that I've yet to really engage.
Okay.
And I'm really looking forward to watching that. I just remember watching Marv Albert and Frank Layden, just Layden dialed up to 11. And that being the most entertaining thing to me as a young kid, and kind of catching up. That was being, I guess, more of, by age, more of a 90s kid than an 80s kid. That was like my education on the stuff that I was just a little bit too young to miss.
Mm-hmm.
And I do wonder if their approach would hold up today. But I think we'll see.
I mean, I think it would. I mean, I think those videotapes really were, they were recruitment tools for kids. I mean, that's how I got into the NBA, was through NBA entertainment videos. For me, it was Dazzling Dunks and Basketball Bloopers, which is great. You can find it on YouTube, or Super Slams of the NBA, which I think came out in 1990 or 1991.
Yeah.
Those two for me were like, that those were the gateway drugs for a full blown, NBA addiction, if I could use an indelicate comparison. But yeah, would they work? That's a good question. You know, I think kids are so sophisticated in terms of what they ingest as entertainment, and I think those videos were designed at a different time when kids had different attention spans.
Sure,
I'm not sure. I think there's a chance it might catch on. I think if my daughter is like 12 or 13 and, is interested in NBA history, I think those tapes would be amazing.
Yes, but you kind of already have to have taken the lure, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not sure they would work as an introduction.
Yeah. You don't walk into the living room and go, what's this wacky thing going on here?
Yeah. Also, you know what it is? Like, those things are now so commonplace. Like, if you hop on Twitter or YouTube, those clips, like clips from that night, that day, I mean, they're available. They're readily available. Back in the 80s and 90s, like you had to either seek that stuff out or wait until like the 7:30 Sports Center or the 11 o'clock Sports Center or until NBA Insight stuff was on Saturday morning. So,
or go to the local video store.
Exactly. Yeah. Now that stuff is so readily available. And I think that's also why you're now seeing so many people that are NBA historians on YouTube. Mm-hmm. They're so young, like they're in their 20s, because they're able to find these things.
It's at their fingertips.
Exactly. Yeah. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens when my daughter is, 12, 13, to see how she is getting her, if she's into sports, how she's getting her sports. Is it going to be on her phone? Is it going to be on a computer or a tablet? I'm very reluctant to make a prediction in that sense.
Yeah, I guess me too. I mean, we've got the requisite little Tykes hoop set up in the driveway, but
yeah,
like you said earlier, looking at it through his lens, the things that he finds interesting, I'm just going to go with that. I mean, I'm always going to do the sort of things that I've always done. I'm going to watch basketball at night,
mm-hmm.
and if he wants to join me, then that's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't want my kid to resent. To resent sports. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think this stuff is always better when there's a discovery element to it. I don't want to be, a Marv Marinovich when it comes to, introducing sports into my kid's life. And my wife is also a sports fan. She grew up in Philly or outside of Philadelphia. So she followed the Sixers and the Eagles and the Phillies. And so there's sports in the house. And I think that stuff will just come naturally. And if she's interested in it, if my daughter's interested, pardon me, that's great. If she's not, that's okay too, because sports to me are a retreat. They're always going to be something I can go into, that I can go to, that provides a retreat from the daily aggravations of the world. Mm. And so I think the fact that it's framed in that way for me, I hope that my daughter will see that and see that, oh, well, my, you know, daddy enjoys this and he gets some satisfaction out of this. Maybe I will too. So yeah. And again, if she doesn't, there's a lot of other things in this house that she can turn to. We have other interests. So to me, sports were never a main thing for me. They're always something that I loved, but I never wanted sports or anything to become like my main focus of attention, because I want to be well-rounded and I want my daughter to be well-rounded. I wanted her to be open and curious to other things in the world.
Well said. Is there a player or team that hooked you way back in the day?
Oh boy. Jordan was sort of the introduction, because I think Jordan was sort of the starter kit for any NBA fan. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like the starter pack. Wow, he's flying through the air. And oh, that's awesome. And then as I got a little older, you know, I grew up in Central New Jersey. That was Knicks territory. Mm-hmm. So, you know, watching MSG Network, I got into the Knicks and Patrick Ewing. And then, you know, as time went on, I got into Kevin McHale, because I thought his game was very similar to what I wanted to do as a low post player. I wanted to do the up and unders and the jump hooks and all that neat stuff. But yeah, I think for everyone, Jordan was sort of like the, oh, wow. He was your introduction. And then as you dug deeper, as I did, I got into the Knicks and I became a Patrick Ewing guy and a bit of a John Starks guy. Those early 90s, mid 90s Knicks teams, I grew up rooting for those teams really hard and agonizing really hard.
Yeah, I can imagine why. I remember, so I grew up on Cape Cod and I remember tuning in. I could get the fan pretty good.
Yeah.
On a lot of nights. And while they were making their run to the 94 finals, definitely that team, and you know, good veteran team. I like playing with them in NBA Live 95 as well on the Super Nintendo, because the Celtics were not great.
Yeah, I wasn't that lucky. I didn't have a Super NES. I had a regular old NES.
Oh yeah,
Which I loved. I mean, but the basketball game that I played, it was a terrible game, which was a disappointment.
Considering, I want to know what this is here.
I think you know what this is. Tecmo Basketball?
Tecmo Super NBA Basketball?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was great. I love that game.
But yeah, you can never win a jump ball.
Oh, jump ball? That's just the start of the game.
You can never win a jump ball.
There's so much more else to it.
And all the
players. Just locked down on defense, and then there you go.
All the players looked the same. There was no differentiation. There was.
They did, but it was, you know, it was the era. You had the actual rosters. It was, I felt. Not to sound like such a first world problem, I kind of had to wait for my Super NES to come. You know, all the other kids, it seemed like they had it for a year or two. And then, you know, I got it one Christmas or something like that. So I still had the NES and I was addicted to Tecmo Super NBA Basketball, because it was, to me, it was the best thing that the most current thing that I could absorb.
It was, I'm not going to say that I was a snobby video game kid. I mean, when that came out, I was like, oh, great. And I played the hell out of that.
Yeah,
but it wasn't Super Tecmo Bowl was amazing, and I was when I found out that Tecmo had an NBA game.
Oh, your expectations!
I was like, oh my god, this is going to be like the best thing ever. And then to play it, it's like it was good, and you could play a whole season, but it wasn't the same, and it was just it didn't have that wow factor that Tecmo Bowl had. The first two, I should say. Yeah. I mean, who did I play with that? I don't know if I had a team with Super NBA Tecmo. I think it was just whoever. I think I just took different teams and just had long runs with them. Like the Clippers, I played really well with. I remember
those Clippers teams. I mean,
Boy Vaught and Ron Harper, Danny Manning
and Charles Smith, Gary Grant. I mean, just super fun Clippers teams. Go figure.
And they were very good on that game. I don't know. I remember having a really good run with them. But yeah, I don't. But Double Dribble was okay. I mean, there were some. Yeah. There wasn't like a great
Arch Rivals.
Arch Rivals is pretty good. This is funny. When I was dating my wife, she had an NES.
Nice.
Like she had and she had Arch Rivals. We would play that a lot.
Certainly.
So she knew what she was getting into. But yeah, that was a good game. The arcade version is really good of Arch Rivals. That's a really good arcade version.
Switch gears a bit to the book. Pete Cruotta, the author of From Hang Time to Prime Time, Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern Day NBA. takes us kind of from the Wild West, the late 70s NBA, into the heart of the Magic Bird Jordan era.
Mm-hmm.
NBA All-Star Weekend, a recurring theme of your book. And we've kind of discussed our respective ages and our genesis as fans. Some of us have grown up with NBA All-Star Weekend just kind of there. And, you know, when I was starting to watch, you had, you know, Kenny Skywalker and Dominique Wilkins and Dee Brown and Cedric Ceballos with the blindfold. And it just goes from there. And the three-point shootout was always entertaining. But it's interesting to imagine what you describe pre-David Stern as All-Star Weekend being a, quote, trade show, the players, weary conventioneers, and high tops. It sounds like it was this mid-season thing that they just kind of did to do it. The league was giving tickets away.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's hard to imagine given the images that you juxtapose later in the text. You know, Larry Nance winning that first dunk contest, going to Jordan, Larry Bird kicking people's ass in the three-point contest.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild to imagine a banquet at NBA All-Star Weekend around some owner's pool where they set up eight, you know, buffet tables.
No, I mean, that's the crazy part of it. I mean, I started following the NBA sort of in depth, like in the early 90s, like 92, 93. And All-Star Weekend was always the event.
Yeah.
And it was an event that was geared toward kids, people my age at the time. You know, you got to see the three-point shootout. There was, you know, there was a slam dunk. Those are all kid events. You know, I'm 43 now. And I don't know, the slam dunk contest to me just seems like it goes on for 3 hours and there's really not much that happens. The three-point shootout is great because I think it's super competitive. The best players seem to compete in that event. But like, yeah, it's always but you're right. We have lived in a sporting world where the NBA All-Star Game weekend is just it's like the Oscars. It's a basketball fan's Oscar event. Like all the celebrities are there, you know, the rappers are there, the musicians. It's a whole big thing. But yeah, back in the day, the NBA had no. It was just something that they did with the NBA All-Star Game. It was just, you know, again, it was very simple. Like you'd come in on like a Friday night, players come in on a Friday night, coaching staff Friday night. Saturday, there'd be like a banquet that was blah. Like there was as Rick Welts told me, there'd be an unfunny comedian at this banquet who was not really tied into the players that were there. And then Sunday, there'd be a game, and then you'd be on the plane like that night or the next day.
And hopefully you won and got cut a nice check.
Exactly. That's what it was. I mean, Butch Beard, who was an all-star in 1972, like, that was it was a paycheck. Like you went there and you got $500 or $1,000. And at that time, like that was a big deal. Like these players were not didn't have multi-million dollar contracts, a lot of them. And they needed whatever financial help they could get. So yeah, to get a check for $500 and or $1,000 for a day's work, not too bad. And then it became, you know, as the NBA became more business savvy and had this desire to grow bigger under David Stern, to become more of an international force and more of a business force, the All-Star Game became its Super Bowl. And what I mean by that in the book is that it wasn't just about the game. It was about the business opportunities. It was about having a showcase, having something that the NBA could bring its corporate sponsors to, and in turn, its corporate sponsors could bring its clients to show a good time, to show how exciting this was, to wheel out the red carpet. It was also an opportunity for branding. Judy Shoemaker, who's at NBA Properties for a year, told me that, you know, the reason why you have all these events now at All-Star Game Weekend isn't because someone came up with a bright idea for these events. It's because there's a sponsorship involved. Like there's a sponsor who wants to pay good money to have its name attached to an event. So really the evolution of the NBA is very much tied into the All-Star Game and, to be more precise, All-Star Game Weekend.
And it's, I guess, a very American story in a way, too. You know, I mean, baseball is historically the national pastime. Football, I guess people would regard it as the current national pastime. But in terms of the cultural permeation, I mean, you make the point that people weren't just going to show up for Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Michael Jordan. I mean, there were great players in the 1970s as well that were playing in these All-Star games. But it was the corporate culture. It was the consumer culture. It was the society, sneakers, hip-hop, the expansion of cable TV. There's just so many different elements that all combined. So if you have a Mount Rushmore of the NBA in the 80s, maybe it is Magic, Bird, Jordan, and David Stern.
Yeah.
But there's just so much working underneath that surface of that mountain.
No, you're absolutely right. It, to me, it's somewhat of a disservice to say that, oh, well, the NBA became big when X person entered the league, like Magic and Bird. Mm. And look, and again, I'm not taking anything away from what Magic and Larry did or Michael Jordan. They, you know, their contributions to the game's popularity is massive. There are so many people who work behind the scenes, who worked with David Stern, who turned the NBA into this palatable, entertaining product. It's the folks with Nike and Converse and even Adidas. It's CBS Sports who saw the NBA as something that was more than just a time killer on Sunday afternoons.
Or the horse contest.
Horse contest. It's the folks who worked for David Stern, such as Bill Marshall in apparel, Don Sterling at NBA Entertainment and his crew there that kind of found the best of the NBA and packaged it in highlight videos and commercials. There are so many moving parts of the NBA's success in the book's timeline from 75 to 89 that it is that. And that's what I wanted to show. I mean, so when someone says, well, it was Bird and Magic and Stern and Jordan. Yes, absolutely. You're correct. But there are so many people who are behind, who are holding up that Mount Rushmore. You know, if Mount Rushmore was held by pulleys and levers and people were kind of holding that facade up, there are a ton of people that held that facade up and helped to build that facade. I think this book does a really good job of showing those people and the role that they played. I mean, even someone like Gary Bettman, who, you know, is now the NFL commissioner.
I noticed him in there. Definitely
played a big role. And yeah, it's, you know, the people that get the credit should, rightfully so. David Stern to me is the best sports commissioner of all time. Mm-hmm. But there are people that did the work who, you know, I think too often don't get the attention that they deserve.
You mentioned CBS Sports, and for a lot of listeners, they're probably going to remember the NBA on NBC and Roundball Rock and the shiny 1990s projection of the league, which is, I think, the last chapter of your book. But CBS Sports, NBA going from kind of an afterthought. This is a podcast fighting out of Boston, Massachusetts, so we got to mention something that Tommy Heinsohn said, and that's, he goes, every game is different. Every game can be a murder mystery. And it was CBS kind of switching their coverage of the game from trying to explain the game to you. You figured it out for yourself with the play of the players, and the commentators were just there to fill in the knowledge gaps.
It was that, but it was also the way the game was shown. And CBS did a few things very, very well. The first thing, and Dick Stockton brought this up when we spoke, he said, do me a favor, call me back in about a week and watch some of the intros to the show. Watch some of the intros to the NBA and CBS. And I, you know, like a dutiful student, I followed his instructions.
Dick Stockton tells you to do something, you're going to.
Yeah, you jump, you hop to it. So I called him up about a week later, and he said, okay, well, what did you see? I said, well, to me, it sounds like all of these broadcasts were almost like a feature story, where you are brought up to speed. There's an introduction to the game. So there's with what's at stake, what these teams are doing coming in, and then you have sort of the sideline reporters providing color. Then you have the body of the story, which is the game, and the game has dramatic elements that you can trump up and highlight. And that was what CBS did. They offered a more sophisticated presentation of the game, where it wasn't just, okay, well, we're going to show, you know, well, let's talk about Michael Jordan. Well, no, Michael Jordan's just one part of this game. Let's also talk about Scottie Pippen. Let's talk about Bill Cartwright. Let's talk about what they're bringing to the game. And it was also bringing in color. It was having Pat O'Brien present these halftime reports.
Right.
Where you got to see the players as more than just bodies on a court. It was also someone like Sandy Grossman, who was a famed director, did a lot of great work on NFL broadcasts, showing you nuances of the game, showing you emotional components of the game, whether it was Larry Bird waving a towel or Michael Cooper, that famous shot of him lying back on the on the Great Western Forum floor.
After the Rockets beat him, yeah.
Yeah. It was presenting the game almost in journalistic and cinematic terms, and also in terms where you could see the personalities of the players and where they weren't just, again, guys throwing the ball down, the ball through the hoop. So CBS did such a good job of this that, and this is in the book too, that when NBC got the NBA, Ed Desser, who's with NBA Entertainment, and his colleagues, when they first met with NBC, they had a list of notes saying, like, this is what CBS did. This is what we want you to do. That's how good CBS's coverage was. And if you look at the coverage now, which is readily available on YouTube, it holds up, and it's very much the model of what NBC did. What NBC did was they made it much more about individual matchups. They made it much more of an event with like eight cameras, and they also did and this is what made David Stern's heart sing. They did a wonderful job promoting the product. Yeah. You know, CBS only had so much bandwidth to devote to the NBA, because remember at the time, CBS had the NFL, they added Major League Baseball, they had golf, they had tennis.
College hoops, right?
Exactly, they had everything. So CBS could only offer so much in terms of promotion. NBC had little else. So they were able to promote the hell out of these events. And they were also able to give David Stern NBA Insight stuff, which got the kiddies involved, like myself, to watch the game and follow the players and get really psyched for the NBA. So, but I'm glad you brought that up with CBS Sports, because I think there are a few unsung heroes in the NBA's history. Mm-hmm. And I think Ted Shaker and, you know, Dick Stockton and Brett Musburger and Tommy Heinsohn and Leslie Visser, Pat O'Brien, that whole crew deserves a lot of credit for turning the NBA into an entertainment outlet for not only sports fans, but for fans that weren't fans yet.
And allow me, if you will, to kind of work in another Boston anecdote. But
okay,
another thing you could market to the kiddies, I guess, would be the three-point shot.
Mm-hmm.
And Red Auerbach, who is described in the book as a huge NBA power broker back in the day, he argued that the three would ruin the purity of the game. And you know what? As we sit back and have conversations nowadays in the sports bars that have become our homes, where we argue about what's going on in the NBA, you could argue that the three is great in moderation. What's going on today is ridiculous. You could argue that it's great and it's just the evolution of the product. But Red had a point, whether it was right or wrong back in the day. Interestingly, if you're a young Celtics fan in this market, you know that Boston's Chris Ford was the first NBA player to make a three. But it's just wild to think of a time where now in a single contest, teams are combining for upwards of 73 point attempts a game, a time where it didn't exist, and the NBA's old guard was solidly against it.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I mean, it's so funny. When I started watching the games, if a player took like three or four three-point shots a game, that was a lot. It's like, gunning.
You know, like Vernon Maxwell having one of those nights, and that gives you a reputation when you start doing that, right?
Yeah, no, it's amazing how that's evolved. Not only that, but just the way the players use the three-point line. I mean, to me, Steph Curry is the best example of this, because he treats the three-point line like it's part of a mid-range game. I mean, he's crossing people up. He's using the three-point line almost like a foul line. And
he gets to the spot. It just happens to be further away.
Exactly. And he's doing things like crossing guys over or moving at the ball. That's just that, again, you would see that if you were a high school coach, like you're taught to curl to the free throw line, shoot a jump shot. He's doing that with a three-point line. It's insane. But to go back to your point, I think the one thing in reporting this book that I think was eye-opening to me is this whole notion that the NBA has tradition. I think what makes the NBA great, and I think what makes the NBA appealing to younger fans, is that there is no tradition. There really isn't. The tradition is that there's no tradition, as Joe Cohen told me, who's the founder of MSG Network. That's the beauty of the NBA. So if baseball had something like the three-point line, like if there was, I don't know, if there was some wrinkle in the game that got everyone hot and bothered, the world of baseball would stop, and the purists would have their home, would be whipped into a frenzy. But with the 3-point shot, I think you see that's really a good example of what the NBA is that it's always evolving. There's always going to be something new. And that's why I think there isn't the stink that there is about the 3-point line that you would see if something like that happened in another sport, especially baseball. The NBA's tradition is that there's no tradition. So Steph Curry launching 3-pointers, you might be like, well, that's unusual, but like that's just part of the game. The game goes in ebbs and flows. And now, you know, it's funny. Now, like, you know, Joel Embiid's having this great season. He's doing a lot of low post work. Mm-hmm. So now there's some talk about, oh, the center's back. That's what the NBA is all about. The NBA is all about never sticking to the script, which I think why it's so fun to watch, because you never know what's going to happen season to season. And yeah, I mean, you might have purists, and of course, you know, am I a big fan of the 3-point teams, jacking up 3-point shots a game? Not really. But that's the game right now, and the game will come back. You know, it's nothing is ever static with the NBA or with how basketball is played in the NBA. And that's what I love about it, is that it's different, and it also gives a chance for different players to shine. You know, a guy like Steph Curry, you know, 15, 20 years ago, he would be a specialist. He'd be Steve Kerr.
Yeah.
But now he's a unicorn. Yeah, now he's a unicorn. It's great. I think that's great.
Well, Pete, for this All-Star weekend, it's obviously going to be different from what we've been accustomed to. Perhaps a little more in line with the NBA All-Star weekends that you profiled in your book, as the league, again, as you mentioned, evolved. The version of the NBA in the 1980s is a blueprint of what we have now. It's just so much bigger. And when you talk some of the numbers and the dollar signs in the course of your text, it's wild to consider how much it grew. And I enjoyed the read. I think that much should be evident, and I'd certainly recommend it to other folks. You know, thanks for hanging out.
My pleasure.
We could probably talk hoops all day, but it's you know, there's other demands for our time as well. Pete Carotta, the author of From Hang Time to Prime Time: Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern Day NBA. And I'll just share, it's available lots of places, but it's nice to ask your local bookstore first. Keep our small and independent businesses thriving. And I got great customer service when I contacted Odyssey Books in Ithaca, New York, which is where you're from. So
yeah.
But Pete, best of luck to you, and thanks for taking some time to talk about your thoroughly researched and very entertaining group.
Thank you, Sean. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. This was a lot of fun, as you could tell.
Awesome.